Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Jeanette Abney, and I want to thank you for joining me here for another episode here at Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. I want to say that it seems like it's getting a little cooler now. Thank you, Jesus, because this heat has been no joke. So please remember to stay hydrated and remember to please take care of yourself. And watch out for the babies and the seniors and the other animals because this heat is not playing with us. So, today, again, I want to thank you for joining me on the air. I have a very interesting show today because this is something that I always tell people I'm going to stay in my lane. But I'm going to say I may know a little bit about some of this topic, but not a whole lot when it comes to what we're going to be talking about. Now, today's topic is how to use sensuality to deal with adversity. Now, when we talk about adversity, many individuals have endured their share of adversity, and in today's world, there appears to be, it seems are getting tougher, as many individuals struggle with many types of adversities. Now, I don't believe that if you're going to be, or I always say when we talk about adversity, we talk about problems, we talk about situations, I always say if you're not going to be part of a solution, don't add to the problem. So it looks like my special guest has called in. So I'm going to be introducing a gentleman who is actually contacting us from Europe, and his name is John Vesperin. Now let me log him in. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Hi, Jeanette. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. I know you've been trying to connect with me for a while to come on the air to talk about what you got going on, and I really appreciate it. Okay?
Thank you,
now,
Jeanette.
I want to give the listeners some background about you in regards to what you indicated. Now, John is the author of 9 books about rational living, a practical philosophy based on lessons from history. Since 2009, John is combining his books, his passion for history, personal finance, and personal development. His books include When Everything Fails, Try This, Rationality is the Way to Happiness, The Philosophy of Builders, The 10 Principles of Rational Living, Rational Living, Rational Working, Consistency is the Key to Permanent Stress Relief, On Becoming Unbreakable, Thriving in Difficult Times, is what you did in 2016, and the most recent book is Sensuality, The Amazing Power of Finding the Right Sequences of Step. So, John, again, I want to thank you for joining me, but tell the listeners, first of all, what is sensuality? Because as you tell, I struggle with even pronouncing a word. But what does that word mean?
Yeah, sequentiality comes from a sequence. And this is the main idea of the book, that when you're facing adversity, when you have to make difficult decisions, instead of trying to get into your head, becoming very emotional, and instead of panicking, one of the best formulas is to try to find the right sequence of steps in a very cool, very objective way by looking at history and by looking at what people have been doing in similar situations. Because then you can really find the answer very easily, avoiding emotions that can drive you in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, John, last week I did a show and I talked about emotional maturity. And where are you located? Because I believe it's in Europe. But what part of Europe?
I'm located in the Netherlands.
Oh, the Netherlands. Okay. Now, it's interesting, John, because I know that when we talk about history, and over in the United States, we have, you know, our grandparents, our ancestors, you know, we always say history repeats itself. And I tell, and many of my listeners know that my show is basically in honor and memory of my mom, whose name was Precious. But it's interesting because she used to always say, been there, done that, got my T-shirt. And a lot of times we try to not repeat history or we try to change things for the better and for the best. Now, I have some information that I found on the Internet, and it was a quote, and it says, challenges are what makes life interesting, but overcoming them is what makes life or what makes them meaningful. Because a lot of times when we're talking about adversity, we've all have dealt with certain different types of adversity. Now, it also indicates the struggle you're in today is developing the strength you will need for tomorrow. So can you give us a few examples?
Yes. The idea from the book came from the story of Luigi Cornaro. I was reading the biography of Luigi Cornaro last year, and he was the first man in history who actually lived 102 years. He was severely sick when he was in his 30s. He was told to go home and die because he was so so sick. He had inflammation. He could barely eat. He could not sleep. He had pain in his whole body. And the way Cornaro recovered his health by taking very small steps and by trying different diets and different formulas gave me the idea for the book. Because instead of getting completely desperate, because when people tell you, you are going to die and there is no cure for your cancer, for your leukemia, wherever it is, when people tell you you're going to die, people usually collapse. And Cornaro, instead of collapsing, he very calmly started to try different approaches to recovering his health. He became a vegetarian. He started to eat very few calories. He went to bed very early. He changed his complete lifestyle, and eventually he came up with a lifestyle that helped him recover his health. And he continued with this lifestyle for decades. He actually wrote about it when he was in his 90s, and he lived 102 years. And this is the kind of stories I tell in the book about people who have been facing terrible adversity and have found the right sequence of steps, very often by trial and error.
You know, John, I want to give the listeners some information because, like I said, when we talk about adversities, many times we think of them as crisis. We look at them as a problem. And I always say when, you know, because I'm very spiritual, how they say, how big is your problem, how big is your God? But not only that, when we talk about adversity, many times we look at the challenges and we always say, I can't. I have a sister. She always would tell me what she could not do. And I would say, well, if you can't, I can't either. Now, here are six kinds of trials that you might face, and then we can go into some of the things that you can do to get out of them or be on the other side. One of them is a physical adversity, which is one of the things John is talking about when he was talking about someone's health. Now, a physical disability is the most obvious example of physical adversity. We also have mental adversity because we have many individuals that struggle and deal with mental health issues, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, just to name a few. We have emotional adversities where individuals have difficulty sometimes handling their emotions. Social adversities, spiritual adversities, and financial adversity. Now, John, I like the concept that you use in regards to talking about the examples that you gave, but in your books, why are you so skeptical about positive thinking?
Because for most people, it's not sustainable. There is about 5%, 10% of the population who can sustain a very high energy. They can be positive under all circumstances, and to stay this way, day after day. But this is a very unlikely situation for most people because about 90% of the population, we don't have enough energy to be super positive all the time. And I came up with a concept of sequentiality as a low energy approach to solving problems because it is not self-evident when you have severe sickness. When you have lost your job, when you have problems in your marriage, it's not self-evident to remain positive. And for most people, it might be easier to try to find the right sequence of steps.
Now, it's interesting you said that because, like I said, in regards to some of them that I named, there's also more. Some individuals have endured childhood trauma, like you said, divorce. Those some other things that can lead or have, you know, challenges that individuals face when you're talking about adversity. Now, according to research or your research, what is the best method for personal development?
Yeah, by far, the best way to make great decisions and to develop yourself as a person in your career, in your private life, is to take an approach of looking at your life in terms of a lifetime. And this is something that is very difficult to do for human beings. We tend to think in terms of weeks or months, sometimes years, but to think in terms of a lifetime will give you the perspective to get over problems, to get through adversity, because you know you're going to live most likely to your 80s, to your 90s, and if you have problems in the short term, they will not look so terrible if you look at them in terms of a lifetime. This is something that you have to remind yourself of every day. It's very difficult to do, but once you get the habit of looking at your decisions and your problems in terms of a lifetime, it makes it easier to find the right answer.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and that is true, because I'm a licensed therapist, and being a therapist, I listen to a lot of individuals that come to me with relationship issues, mental health issues, bad habits, and these are some of the adversities that is affecting them in their day-to-day life, at work, or in their relationships. And a lot of times, individuals, when you're positive, they don't want to be positive because they don't know how to be positive despite or in spite of what they're feeling, in spite of what they're going through. Because, you know, when we talk about steps, we would tell them one step at a time, or, you know, if at first you don't succeed. So we have a lot of rituals, a lot of things that we would tell individuals, but sometimes they don't want to hear it, especially, I know, in the therapy world, because sometimes they want to talk, but they don't always want to do anything about it, or they're afraid. Now, you've written 9 books so far. If there's a common thread going through them all, or what do you see in regards to the connection between the books that keeps you motivated going from book to book?
Yeah, the common thread that goes through the book is how to make better decisions. And this is, for me, a lifetime mission to try to find the history by going through hundreds of biographies, to try to find the principles, the patterns, that help us make better decisions. It's very difficult to memorize a formula. The only way I have found to be able to be more rational, to make better decisions day after day, is to extract the principles from practical examples, to look at hundreds of stories, to see what people have done in similar situations. And then when you're facing these kind of problems, the story will come back to your memory, and you will be able automatically to make the right decision.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when you're seeing and as you're speaking, because I've never spoken with you before, and it's bringing to my mind, you know, because I also work with individuals that have drug and alcohol problems, and we would always say that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And I know one of my co-therapists, every time I would do something, she'll say, "So how did that work for you?" And I remember my mother used to always tell me, "Jeanette, how many times I got to tell you the same thing over and over and over again?" So sometimes people learn differently. Sometimes they don't, like I said, we have this mental blockage where we want to do what we want to do despite knowing that we should be doing something different. Now, getting back to your book, why do you place so much emphasis on health and longevity in your book?
Because when you try to learn a new habit, a new philosophy to improve your life, you have to take it into the right context. It's not enough to give people advice or to tell them formulas that are isolated and they don't fit in the complete framework of their lives. And this is why I find many books about personal development so weak, because they tell you bits and pieces of a possible formula, but if you don't place emphasis on long-term success and long-term happiness and long-term health. And this is why I consider longevity a very important factor. And when I look at biographies of successful people, the first thing I check is how many years they lived. Because if someone was super successful but died in his 20s or his 30s, I'm very skeptical. I believe it's much better to build a career little by little, to try to make good decisions every day and to take good care of your health, because personal development without health, without an emphasis on longevity, it might drive you in the wrong direction by pursuing the short-term interests that are detrimental in the long term.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know about over in the Netherlands, but I know over in the United States we have a lot of pervasive developmental disorders in children, even in adults. We're dealing with obesity, we're dealing with diabetes, and as you know, cancer, and we have dementia, Alzheimer's, and it's sad. But not only that, a lot of individuals, it seems like they're living longer, but it seems like they're actually not. I just went online today and saw that there was a rapper that just died at 31. So death is one of those things that we take our health for granted, it seems like. Now, how do you explain that dozens of millions of people feel so depressed that they can barely function? How do you explain that in your book?
Yeah, I link this massive wave of depression to a wrong philosophy. If you have a very unrealistic view of life, and you expect things to happen that are very unlikely, it is inevitable that you get depressed and you get discouraged because you will be constantly expecting miracles. And this is not the way life works. By becoming more realistic, and this is why I consider so important to look at history, to look at practical examples, the more realistic you become more effective. You'll be making better decisions, and you will get into your goals much faster. But the reason for so many depressed people, anxiety, high stress, is basically lack of realism.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? And we always say we're going to keep it real, we're going to keep it 100, but we really don't, because a lot of times individuals don't want to do that. I have a friend, he always say, look in the mirror. Or when people look in the mirror, and it's interesting because we like watching reality television. We like living in a fantasy world, but we also so used to being in stressful situations and environments. Now, according to your research, what is the number one reason that is making people get stuck? Because we know people are people, they go do what they want to do. And for those listeners out there that are listening, I want to hear from you, John. What do you think is the number one reason why people get stuck?
According to my research, especially in this book where I look at people who have actually wasted their possibilities, the reason why so many people get stuck nowadays is because they're very, very much hypersensitive. And today in the 21st century seems to be a great fashion to become extremely upset about what someone said, about what's happened today, when people read the news, when they get any kind of inconvenience in their lives, people are super hypersensitive. If they get criticized or they get into conflict of some way, people become so upset that sometimes they cannot really function anymore. This is completely stupid, but it is built in our psychology as human beings. You have to force yourself to become more balanced. Let me just give you some little story from the book. One of the stories I recount in the book is the life of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. He was a great artist in the 19th century in Great Britain. He actually was not only a great painter, but also a poet. And the problem with Rossetti is that despite his genius, he was very, very sensitive. He was hypersensitive. He got a few bad reviews in newspapers for some painting, and actually the painting was very good, but it was very innovative, and the critics didn't like it. He got a few bad reviews, and he started to drink. He became an alcoholic very early in life, and eventually he stopped painting altogether because he was very depressed. And this kind of hypersensitivity in today in the 21st century, it is widely spread. There are millions of people suffering from this pattern, and this is something you have to get rid of because otherwise you cannot progress.
You know, John, I'm laughing as you were talking because the first thing you said, well, that's stupid, you know, and Bob Newhart did a skit on one of the shows he had, and it was Stop It. And a lot of times we say those type of words, individuals become very offended. And I understand what you mean when you indicated that they are hypersensitive. And I always tell individuals, even in therapy, that individuals basically take things personal. And everything is not meant to harm you. So we have to be, because words are very, very powerful. And a lot of times when I used to talk about self-criticism, and I used to constructive criticism, I used to say, what is so constructive about criticism when you're beating someone down? But a lot of times individuals will do that just to be mean. And a lot of individuals are dealing with their own internal conflict, their own internal adversity, and sometimes they may take it out on other people. So I always emphasize, when you know better, you do better. Now, your books are based on history. Why should anyone care about what happened a long, long time ago?
Because human behavior and human psychology has always been the same for centuries, for thousands of years. And we have the tendency to focus on the news of what happened today, what happened yesterday. We become super upset because this guy said this thing and this woman said that thing. We look at the short term and we exaggerate the impact. History is very important because it gives you perspective. If you see how people actually have faced great adversities centuries ago and they have been able to survive and to thrive, this will give you inspiration and will give you ideas about how to solve your problems. But you have to really get the picture that human life has not changed fundamentally. We have the same psychology as the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks, and we have to learn from the stories that we can see in history, because otherwise the human psychology will drive us to make always the same mistakes.
Mm-hmm. And I agree, because a lot of times we do, like I said with my mom, she'd always say, why do I always have to say the same thing over and over again, which she did, because I would still do the same stuff over and over again. Now, when we're talking about not only with history, and history do repeat itself, what would you say is one of the most surprising lessons that you've learned from history?
Yeah. If I just pick up one, I would say that we have this tendency as human beings to reinvent the wheel. And it is surprising that in the 21st century, we're making basically the same mistakes that people have been making for centuries. I mean, everybody that has started a new business or has gone into a new relationship or has moved to a new city will tend to make exactly the same mistakes that people have been making hundreds of years ago. Well, and why is this? Let me just give you an example. One of the stories I recount in the book is the exploration of Antarctica, the South Pole, where it's very, very cold. And during the early years of the 20th century, several expeditions went to Antarctica to try to find resources and to actually to plant their flag on the South Pole. And this is very interesting, the story, because you see several people going there from different countries, from Scotland, from England, from Norway. And one of them actually organized everything correctly. He was very successful. He came, he went, and he returned without a scratch. While the other people, they went there and they died. They died a horrible death. They froze. They drowned. It was really horrible. Hundreds of people. We are talking about a large cruise. They actually died. They became injured. just because of their lack of preparation. And these people had a huge amount of resources. They have sponsors, they have millions of dollars in budget, but eventually they made the same mistakes over and over again. Because the human nature, we tend to be so arrogant that we don't want to check what other people have done in the similar situations. We want to reinvent the wheel. We want to be the first to do something. And most of the time, it is not very clever. You can really avoid in life a massive amount of mistakes if you just look, spend some time looking at what other people are doing. And this is what the explorers in Antarctica failed to do. Only one of them actually took the trouble to figure out what kind of clothing you need, and he took furs, while the other people were actually wearing woolen clothes, and as soon as they got wet, they froze. And only one guy actually took the trouble to check, okay, what kind of clothes are people wearing in Siberia? And he realized that you have to wear furs, because otherwise it will freeze in the winter. And this was the only guy who actually took the trouble to figure out how many dogs he needed, because he calculated the lifetime of the dogs, he calculated the amount of food, and he took the right amount of dogs. I mean, it was not super complicated, but the other people didn't do it. And this is human nature. We always make the same mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and I want to tell the callers, if you want to, or the listeners out there, if you want to call in, if you have any questions for my guests, John, or for myself, you can call in at 516-387-1914. Again, if you have any questions regarding today's show, give us a call, 516-387-1914. And even though we're talking about the adversity, and we're not really touching on the different types, which I can do a follow-up show and give you guys some more insight in regard to that. But, John, I have a question. Because as I'm looking at so many information that you've indicated, and like I said, you're in the Netherlands, we're in the United States. We're dealing with a lot of different issues over in the United States, or a lot of different adversities. And one of them which comes to another question that I have, because, you know, we have individuals from all over the world. We used to call America the great, or the United States the great American pot. We have individuals that speak different languages. And a lot of times, especially here recently, it's becoming a big issue where they had this one guy, he went to a cafe, people were speaking Spanish, he got upset, he made a big deal out of it. We got a lot of racial stuff going on. Now, in your book, you indicated that you are recommending people to learn a second language. Why is it important that they learn a second language?
Well, because it will make you much more effective. Actually, it's easy to learn the second language. It's just that in some school systems, they don't emphasize learning a second language. But you have to realize that many children actually grow bilingual without a lot of effort. Huh? It's something that human beings are very good at picking up languages. But you just have to put in the time. And by spending a quarter of an hour per day, I mean, just during your commuting, if you just listen to some CDs, you can pick up a second language. So for Americans, it's super easy. I mean, I'm talking about U.S. Citizens. It's super easy to learn Spanish because you have it very, very close in your environment. And I will tell you, it will open your eyes to a different culture. You will become more tolerant, more benevolent. You will learn a lot of new things about new food, new habits. You will make new friends. And you will see the world in a more open way. And this is very important because when people become very provincial, when we become afraid of other people, of other races, of other cultures, we tend to shrink our mentality. Mm-hmm. We become very, a bit like stupid children. And this is the last thing you want to do. You want to open yourself. You want to learn more. And it's very, very easy, very, very inexpensive to learn another language. And it will help your career. It will help you socially, and you have the opportunity to do it. It's very, very, very good idea, and try to encourage your children to do it because it doesn't take a lot of work. It needs some persistence, But come on, take the opportunity, because if you live in a bilingual country, as most people do nowadays, it is a golden opportunity to advance your career.
And you know what? And I agree. And I know back in my early years of going to school, they were requiring that you take a foreign language, and I learned Spanish. And it's interesting, but one of the things that I've learned is living in California and the Spanish that I was taught in school, because I studied Spanish for about 8 years, when you run into individuals that speak Spanish coming from Mexico, their dialogue is a little different, and their slang is a lot different. So that's one of the things that we have to also take into consideration. And the younger you are, the easier it is for you to grasp a different language, especially before the age of 5. So, I mean, I'm very grateful. I should have continued to where I could become bilingual, but I have children, well, grandchildren that are biracial. And it's interesting because I remember one time their grandfather was speaking in Spanish, and I started talking back to him in Spanish, and he looked at his daughter was like, "Why you didn't tell me she speaks Spanish?" And he didn't realize that I understood exactly what he was saying. And sometimes people use that for their advantage or their disadvantage. And again, individuals going back to being sensitive, they become hypersensitive, and they think that someone is always talking about them in their language, and people get offended by that. And that's not always the case. That's just where they feel most comfortable. Now, and part of our arrogance and our ignorance also keep us stuck where we need to become more open-minded. Now, and also, in regards to not only learning a second language, how can you or how can an overstressed person basically reduce their stress? Because we live in a society where we're constantly on a go. I was speaking to someone yesterday, and I was telling them about all the stuff I had to do. I went to go see clients. I went to church. I went to do a photo shoot. I went to go pick up my friends. We went, and I'm constantly on a go. Now, we know that there's good stressors, and we know that there are bad stressors. But what would you recommend individuals to do as a way of reducing their stress?
Yeah, I have actually devoted a whole book to the subject. And I tell you, the formula is astoundingly easy. The only way to reduce your stress in the long term is to become more consistent, to become integrated, to put all the pieces of the puzzle together so that your life actually fits, your career, your family, your exercise, whatever you're doing has to be consistent. The reason why we become so stressed as human beings is because we tend to chase too many rabbits. We have this innate tendency for novelty. We always want new things. We want entertainment. And at a certain point, if you just keep chasing too many rabbits, you will become overstressed and you will have severe health problems. The only solution to have a life with a reasonable amount of stress, which is good, but not too much, is to be consistent, to have an idea of what you want to do, to have a vision of your next decades, to have a vision for your lifetime, and try to mold your activities around that vision. If you try to do too much, if you try to chase too many rabbits, you will just crash eventually, because your body will not be able to sustain it.
Oh, trust me, I know. I came home Tuesday, and through the grace of God, I slept and didn't even know how I got home. So your body will shut down. I definitely know that. Now, in your research, which lessons have you learned for improving one's health? Because we know stress is a killer. But besides stress, what was the lesson that you've learned for improving one's health?
Yeah, the very best method that we can pick from history is the development of new habits. And it takes some effort. As I was giving an example, to learn the new language, you have to develop the habit of spending 15 minutes a day in your car to listen to a new language. And this goes the same for anything else. If you want to become healthier and you want to lose weight or you want to improve your condition, you have to develop a new habit. It doesn't have to be revolutionary, but if you start developing new habits, it will take you a few weeks until the habit actually sinks in and you do it almost automatically. But then the improvement in the long term will be amazing. Let me just give you an example. Look, one of the habits I pick up myself from my research is the habit of drinking herbal tea. And this is something that I researched when I was doing my book about ancient Greece, about the lifestyle and the lessons from ancient Greece. I researched the work of Hippocrates. He was a great physician in ancient Greece. And one of the prescriptions he gave to every patient is to pick up the habit of drinking herbal tea. I'm talking about chamomile, I'm talking about sage tea, I'm talking about mint tea. These kind of things are very inexpensive, and it's much better for your health than drinking soda. You might look a little weird in the beginning if you drink tea, herbal tea, instead of drinking soda, but I tell you, it's a habit which is very inexpensive, and it can drastically improve your health.
Okay. And you know what? And they're trying to be careful, or I know we're trying to be careful in the United States with sugar. And I know tea tastes horrible to me without sugar. I got to have me some sugar in my tea or in my coffee. But sugar is one of the things that's becoming not everybody's friend nowadays. But the tea can also be used as an antioxidant and a detox for one's body also. Now, in your research and compared to previous periods in history, we are not living in a particular, or are we particularly living in troubled times? What do you have to say in regards to why are we living, or why are we not living in particularly troubled times? Because some would say that we are, but in your book it indicates that, or looking at the way it's compared, what is your input in regards to that?
Well, if you read the news every day, you always get the impression that the world is coming to an end, that the whole civilization is falling apart. But if you look at the big picture, this is actually nonsense. The problem is that human beings, we are so emotional. We like so much to be excited, to be afraid. And this is why we watch news. We become addicted to this constant negativity. But if you look at the big picture and you look at the situation today in the world, in most of the world, and you compare to 100 years ago, we are in a very, very good shape. And there are some trends that are almost invisible because you don't see them in the newspapers every day, but they are very, very much with us for the next decade. I just want to mention them very quickly because you must remind yourself of these trends, I think, almost every day because it will change. They will change your mood. And the first one is that today, in the 21st century, it's so easy and so inexpensive to start a new company. And this is something that few people realize, how cheap it is to start a new company, to start a new internet website, to start a new consultancy. It's very cheap. It has never been so cheap in history. And this is a tendency. It's a huge advantage. I mean, you have to realize that only our parents 50 years ago, they have a huge problem if they wanted to start a company. It will cost them a lot of money and a lot of effort. And today you can do it very inexpensive. You can do it with a few clicks on internet for only a few dollars. And this is a tendency that you don't listen to in the newspaper, in the radio, and the radio newspapers. But it is with us. It's going to stay with us. It's very positive, and it's changing the world. It's making very millions of people independent in different countries, and I think we should be very optimistic about this trend.
Right. And you know what, John, it's interesting because we now, they have indicated that being addicted to computers and iPads and things of that nature is an addiction and it's a mental health issue. But then yet, individuals don't realize they can make millions and millions of dollars just by developing apps. And because people do rely on those apps to help them to basically be able to survive in this world. Now, looking at some of the things that you have indicated, why do we seem unable to eradicate aggressiveness from society? Because when we look at adversity, a lot of times we get angry, we become aggressive, we want to fight, we don't know how to become assertive, or we need to learn to develop appropriate coping skills. But what is your input in regards to why do we seem unable to eradicate aggressiveness from society?
Well, it's a part of human nature to think short term. And this is because to a great extent, we share a lot of characteristics with animals, with dogs, with lions. And when we have to face any kind of danger or any kind of inconvenience, our first reaction is to get angry. This is automatic. And only if you actually take the trouble to think ahead and to try to see things in perspective, you can become more effective and you can avoid this continuous anger. Today, we live in a very angry society. People have a difficulty thinking long term. They only think about what's happening right now, and they don't see sometimes the consequences. And we live surrounded by very angry people, and this is very irrational. It is very, very ineffective. And this is because you have to force yourself, as a human being, you have to force yourself to think long term. It will make you more tolerant, it will make you more effective, and you will realize that most of this anger is just nonsense, it's noise. There is nothing behind it, it's just people getting angry for the sake of getting angry. Try to think long term. As I said, try to think in terms of a lifetime, because it will make you more relaxed, more effective, and I would say much happier.
You know, I always tell an individual, even in therapy, I tell them if you look at anger and you put a D in front of it, you have danger. And a lot of times we get so angry, and especially with all the health risks that we have in the United States with, like I said, with hypertension being one of them, you get so upset, you mess around and stroke out. And I always tell individuals you also have to learn how to fight differently too. And just because you're getting angry, at least you know that that is an emotion. It's a valid emotion. But you can also, you can be angry but sin not. And you can be angry but learn how to develop appropriate conflict resolution skills. Now, your books are advising people to diversify their risk. Why is that?
Because if you just put all your eggs in your basket, for instance, imagine that you only have one friend and you only know how to do one thing. So your job depends on one skill. Your social life depends on one friend. And I could go on and on. You become very vulnerable because if the economy changes, you might lose the job because it becomes redundant and you are replaced by a computer. Maybe your friend dies or leaves to another, moves to another country. And then you are lonely and unemployed. And this is very dangerous. You don't need to do that. One of the main principles of good investing, good investment, is to diversify. You don't want to put all your money on the same investment. You want to spread it as much as possible so that if one of the companies or one of the investments goes south, you still keep 99%. And you should do the same with your skills, with your social relationships. Try to build a diversified asset pool for your skills, for your friendships, for everything, because it can really save your life. People become very angry when they become very desperate, and they believe that they don't have a future, they cannot find another job, and it's completely irrational. It is much better to spend your time diversifying your skills than getting angry because the only skill you have might disappear due to a technology change.
And you know what? And that is true because when you're talking about desperate people will do desperate things. And we also need to be mindful of that. And even when we're talking about the suicidality rate in regards to individuals feeling that they're giving up on life. Now, the book you wrote last year entitled On Becoming Unbreakable, can a person really become unbreakable?
Very much so. If you have a road accident and you crashed your car, of course you will break your bones. But this is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about becoming unbreakable from the point of view of your personal finances, your psychology, And there is a lot you can do to become unbreakable. So what I have done in the book is to show a lot of stories, real stories from different people in the very difficult circumstances, to extract the principles that make people unbreakable. Let me just give you a small example. One of the stories I tell in the book is the story of William Turner. He was a great artist in the 19th century in England. And Turner had a problem because he was very shy. He was a terrible speaker. He was very bad with people. He was very, very introvert. And people make fun of him. Newspapers, they made caricatures of him. They thought he was stupid. He was almost retarded. And for many years, Turner, who was actually a very great genius, he tried to change people's perception. He thought that he was being underappreciated, and it was true. But no matter how much he tried, newspapers continued to crucify him. He was savagely attacked by the newspapers. And eventually, Turner, he did a very clever thing. He said, okay, you don't like me? No problem. I will just stop talking to you. So he stopped completely. He stopped talking to journalists, and he concentrated on his work, and he started to paint one great work after the other. At a certain point, he was concentrating, and he was able to paint five paintings per day. I mean, he was extremely productive. He made a great fortune. He became very famous. He became very established, because at a certain point, he stopped completely. He stopped listening to negative criticism. And he became unbreakable in the sense that I present in the book, because he made the right decision to concentrate on his strengths and to actually stop worrying about his weak points.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, John, and I know you're calling me from the Netherlands, and I have a question for you. And part of it is because I keep hearing the word stupid, retarded. And I know in the United States with retardation, we call it borderline intellectual or functioning. Now, in your country, in your culture, I don't know if that's a word that is very fluent. But my question is, in your books, you're very optimistic about the future. Is this optimism based on facts? Because when I hear those words, and I'm thinking, and I know you said about being hypersensitive, how do they handle that over in the Netherlands? And then we can talk about it a little bit in the United States.
Well, we live in a small country, so it's comparable to only one state, a very small state in the U.S. So we are, in this sense, we are very modest. We realize we cannot do many things because we don't have the budget, we don't have the ability. This is why we try to be very open. We try to trade with everybody. We try to be open to other cultures. And this is something that, to a great extent, is a good formula, because it has allowed many small countries, not only the Netherlands, many small countries in the world to thrive. When you have a lot of power and you have, imagine that, okay, you are very handsome and everybody is running after you and everybody wants to marry you, you tend to become arrogant. You tend to become very much irrational. And this is very bad. It's, I think it's better to develop this kind of modesty, this kind of humility, because it will open your eyes to many opportunities and will allow you to make friends. So this attitude of, I would say, a small countries, and I would even say attitude for a small people who are not having great advantages because they don't have a rich family, they don't have the right education, you develop this kind of resilience and this kind of openness that is very good for personal development, and I think also very good for your career.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you tell someone who is overwhelmed by the many problems and does not know where to start? Because you spoke on that a little bit in regards to sometimes where you come from, because a lot of times I was watching something I was showing to my clients, and it had to do with affluenza. And these are individuals that are rich, and they think that they have a sense of entitlement, and they can do whatever they want, say whatever they want, and then it blows up in their face because they a lot of times lack social skills. And I'm not saying that I have anything against individuals that are rich, but it's basically how they're raising their children, the things that they're instilling in them, their morals, their values, and even we're talking about individuals that are middle class and some that are poor, because we have a lot of biases and misperceptions, and a lot of some of this stuff is fear-based, and we need to learn how to go back to respecting one another. Now, if this individual, based on, like I said, because there's a lot of kids that are born rich that when they get older, they don't like it. They despise it. They become very resentful. And they can view that as a problem. Some individuals are poor. They view that as a problem. What would you tell someone who is overwhelmed by many problems and don't know where to start? How would you and where would you tell them to start?
Yeah, you have to stop comparing yourself with other people. Because, for instance, if you're sick, let's say you have, the flu, and your colleagues don't get the flu, if you compare yourself to them and say, it's not fair. I mean, I get the flu and you're not getting the flu. I mean, it's complete nonsense. And when you extrapolate the principle and you say, okay, I don't have money because I lost my job, I don't have the right education, and you compare yourself to a millionaire, it's a complete waste of time. It's not going to solve your problem. It's going to make you depressed, and it's not going to get you anywhere. The right attitude is to actually look at your problems, to try to be objective, to identify the priorities. If you have 20 problems and you say, okay, I have a toothache and I have a stomach ache, and you have to proceed in the same way as an emergency room. So you go to a hospital, they will immediately identify the critical problem, and they will focus on that. They will focus on that problem to keep you alive. You have to do the same if you have different problems. Focus on the critical problem, solve it, and then go to the next one. Don't try to do everything at the same time. Think like a doctor, like a hospital. Go to the emergency room and say, okay, what is the critical problem? And usually they will say, okay, it's the heart. We have to keep the heart beating because otherwise the patient will die. So in your case, your problem might be financial, so you have to keep earning an income. Even if you don't like your job, just keep it, for God's sake, until you get something better.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, compared to previous areas in history, are we living through a period of ethical decline? Because we're looking at values and morals. What is your input in regards to, are we living through a period of ethical decline?
I think this is something we see in the newspapers every day. People are complaining that children don't listen, that education is going to hell, that the country is going to hell, that the world is going to hell. You get this kind of negativity every day, but it's totally unrealistic. When you look at the education levels around the world, you have today, in the 21st century, many more people who actually can read and write, many more people who have professional skills, many more people who have social skills than in any other period in history. You have to stop focusing on this negativity that you see in the news, because it's very unrealistic. Look at the big numbers, look at the big picture, and you will realize that we live in a world full of opportunity, and you have to go and pick up these opportunities and to improve your life. Stop focusing on this constant negativity, because it's pure nonsense.
Gotcha. Now, John, your book also often mentioned that debating and arguing are mostly a waste of time. Why do you say so? Because I know we always say that it doesn't make sense and we get our emotions all enwrapped, entwined, but why would you say it's a waste of time to in regards to doing all these debating and arguing?
Because it's very difficult to change human beings from an adversarial position. When you have someone who doesn't like you for whatever reason, you can spend your whole life debating that you are really not so bad and that he should actually like you. It's a complete waste of time. Human beings, generally speaking, we don't change our minds through debate. We change our minds through example. And when we see something that is working, and I imagine you have a smartphone and you see a new app, and at the beginning you are skeptical, but when you download it and use it, say, oh, this is really amazing. I never thought I could do it. And then you actually change your habit, because you're going to stop using something else, and you're going to be using the new app. And this is how human beings change. We change through example. We change through experience. We don't change through negative criticism. We don't change through debate. It is fundamentally a waste of time, and all these angry people who spend their whole lives debating, they will never get anywhere.
Okay. Now, when we talk about not only that, and I like your input in regards to debating, now, generally speaking, the Internet has failed to make people more tolerant and wise. And you talked about the smartphone. And I used to always say to the show, are you smarter than a fifth grader? And I used to say, nope, because these kids are very, very intelligent right about now. Now, why do you believe that the Internet has failed to make people more tolerant and wise?
Because unless you try to expand your knowledge and your improve your habits, we have the tendency to reinforce our prejudice. And if you believe something which is some complete nonsense, you look on the Internet, I'm sure you will find some arguments supporting your nonsense. So unless you use, it's like reading books. If you only read one book and you go to the library and you always pick up the same book, you will never become more tolerant. You will just reinforce your prejudice. And this is something that happens in the Internet. A few years ago, many people thought the Internet was going to actually change human psychology, because people will actually learn the facts. They will learn to become more intelligent. But in practice, it doesn't happen. And this is exactly what happened 100 years ago when people had the opportunity to go to school for free in many countries. Many people thought, okay, this is going to change human psychology. Everybody will learn a lot, but it doesn't happen. You have to have the motivation to improve yourself. Otherwise, you can go to school, you can go to the library, you can go to the Internet, but you will not learn anything. You will only waste your time playing games or watching videos of cute cats playing. Uh-huh. But it will not improve your life. You have to really become motivated. Without this motivation, a school, public libraries, the Internet will not have a positive effect.
Gotcha. Now, you know, John, I just left Home Depot because I got to do some home improvements, and I saw that the store at mostly all the places we have was called self-checkout. And I remember being a kid watching the movie or the cartoon The Jetsons, and we was, you know, looking at robots. We was looking at a lot of these different things. Now, millions of people are agonizing that they will soon be replaced by robots and lose their jobs. Does history provide a solution to this problem?
Yes, the solution that history gave us, because this is not a new problem. You have to realize that in the 18th century, people were destroying textile machinery because they didn't want to lose the jobs, because they have a factory and they did all the sewing by hand, so they didn't want to have a machine. And today is the same. Today you have people replaced by computers, call centers replaced by software. It's happening everywhere. And the solution that history gives us is to improve your skills, to diversify your skills, to learn more things, to become, as I said, unbreakable. Because if you have sufficient skills, you speak a second language, you are mobile, you know different things, you become unbreakable. There will not be any technology that will be able to deprive you of the ability to earn a living. It's not about a job, a particular job. It's about the ability to earn a living. And this is something that you get from diversifying your skills.
Gotcha. Now, we got about 90 seconds left on the show. If you could give the listeners just one piece of advice they should keep in mind, what would that be?
Yes, try to think in terms of a lifetime. It is the most important principle I can give you. Don't get discouraged by short-term defeat, by sickness, by financial losses. In terms of a lifetime, it's something you have to do. Think in terms of a lifetime. You will recover. You will find the solution given sufficient time.
And you know, John, I'm going to follow up with this show next week, and I'm going to talk about surviving adversities, because I know you were talking about sequentiality and talking about the steps and taking one step at a time, and I get that. And a lot of times individuals, we got to, you know, keep reiterating things. And I want to give the listeners more information about how to survive these adversities, who, and give them real-life people who have survived adversities. Now, how can the listeners find your book? How can they find you?
I'm very, very easy to find. If you just type my name, John Vespasian, on Google or any search engine, you will find everything in a second. You will find my website. You will find my free newsletter, my blog, my books. Just type John Vespasian on Google. You will find everything in 1 second.
Well, John, I want to thank you for diligently reaching out to me, wanting to be a guest on the show. I hope that the audience enjoyed what we had to say in regards to this, and that they will definitely continue to view adversities differently and sometimes laughing at your adversities. So if you join us here on the show today, I want to thank you for listening, and I will be talking next week about surviving an adversity. So until then, remember, you got this. Thank you for joining me and along with my guest, John, as we talked about how to use sequentiality to deal with adversity here at Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, John.